From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. What can a liberal arts college education do for a prison inmate? Goucher College has professors teaching courses in two Maryland prisons.
I had my initial doubts and just thinking, you know, why are they going to care about Latin America? And I was so pleasantly surprised right from day one.
We tagged along with Tom Hall visiting classes at Jessup. Then we welcome back the Maryland Film Festival's Jed Dietz and Washington Post film critic Ann Hornaday to recap the Oscar winners and tell us about some other movies they're keeping an eye on. Plus, a scheme by several Tillman Island watermen to poach $500,000 worth of striped bass from the Chesapeake Bay shows the tension between the watermen and the regulators of Maryland's seafood harvest. We talk with a journalist covering the case for the Baltimore Sun. First News.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. This morning, we're revisiting a story we first aired last October. In the spring of 2014, Tom Hall sat in on a couple of unusual college classrooms. In a spacious library, a political science class discusses why some political movements succeed while others don't. In another classroom, the subject is Latin American history. The professors are from Goucher College, but the classes aren't held on Goucher's bucolic Towson campus. They're being conducted in prisons at Jessup.
Both of these forms of politics mobilize ordinary citizens.
Professor Rachel Templer is teaching a class called Understanding Politics. Her students listen intently and quietly jot down notes. 16 women sit in groups of three or four at several large tables that are bathed in sunlight on a crisp April afternoon.
It's within the small issues that they build the power and political recognition that they need to tackle larger issues.
That's Elizabeth.
My name is Elizabeth Starnes, and I'm 43 years old.
Until just a few years ago, Elizabeth had never taken a college course.
I wasn't so bad in elementary and middle school. I failed ninth grade of high school, and I did what I had to do to get by and really had no interest in attending college.
But as of this summer, she's earned 29 college credits.
When I took pre-calculus, I swore up and down that I would not take Calculus 1 because I would cry through the whole thing. And now I'm in Calculus 1. I got 103% on my midterm exam, and now I'm pushing for Calc 2, statistics, anything, math.
Elizabeth was convicted of armed robbery and conspiracy to armed robbery. She told us she's scheduled to be released in 2026.
We have folks serving life sentences or multiple life sentences to those individuals serving 1 year and a day.
That's Margaret Chippendale. She's the warden at the Maryland Correctional Institution for Women. It houses 800 inmates.
The public would have to spend time inside of an institution, particularly an institution such as this, because if they sat down one-on-one with these ladies, they wouldn't know who was an offender and who was a citizen.
There are about 21,000 people in Maryland's prison system. That's how many people live in Cumberland. In the last 35 years, Maryland's prison population has nearly tripled. And Maryland is not alone. According to a Human Rights Watch report released last May, state prison populations have grown more than 240% in the last 29 years.
We're one of the leaders, if not the leader in the world, in terms of the percentage of our population that's incarcerated.
That's Sandy Unger. He was the president of Goucher College until he retired in June. Goucher began the Prison Education Partnership in 2012.
We believe that when we talk about underserved populations, disadvantaged people who are not having equal access to a higher education, one of the primary populations that is neglected is the prison population, the incarcerated population of women and men.
In the 1960s in U.S. prisons, there was a real investment in rehabilitation and also education.
Keramet Ryder is a criminology professor at the University of California, Irvine. She's taught in prisons in New York, California, and Massachusetts. She says the amount of money put into educating inmates has ebbed and flowed over the years. 20 years ago, there was a shift away from investment in prison education programs. That peaked with the passage of a law taking away Pell Grants from prisoners in 1994.
Prior to that, prisoners were eligible, if they didn't have any money to their name, which most prisoners don't, they were eligible for financial support to do both correspondence and in-prison college programs. When that support was eliminated in the 90s, a lot of existing programs shut down.
But she says that trend is changing.
I think right now we're in a period of a kind of upswing of reinvestment, both socially and with nonprofits and also government investment in thinking about how education can be put back in prison.
Many prisons have GED programs, but college degree programs have sprung up in prisons as well, including those with a liberal arts focus like Goucher's. They're run by schools like Bard College and Cornell University in New York and Grinnell College in Iowa. Some in the corrections field think that job training and skills-based education is still the best bet for incarcerated people, and that training in a trade will increase their chances of finding employment when they're released from prison. So why offer a liberal arts curriculum to inmates?
They give students the tools they need to go out and finish a college education or apply to graduate school or get further education, as opposed to some of the programs that are more geared towards job skill training, which can be much more limited.
The courses that Goucher offers at Jessup are not a cakewalk.
We're offering statistics, where we may offer pre-calculus.
Amy Rosa is the Goucher Prison Education Partnership's director.
This education that Goucher offers empowers students, whether they're up in Towson or out in Jessup, to be fully engaged politically, socially, and professionally. It's the kind of dynamic education that allows you to really make the most in a changing economy and with changing technology over your lifetime.
A cohort of 70 students are enrolled. The syllabus, the coursework, and the expectations of students are the same in both Towson and Jessup. More than 350 inmates have written letters asking how to apply to the program. That's five times more than the program has room for. And just like the pool of applicants to Goucher in Towson, not all of the students who apply meet the program's qualifications.
We offer a suite of college preparatory classes for students who are not yet ready for rigorous college work. So we'll be offering basic academic writing and either pre-algebra, algebra 1, or algebra 2 in some combination.
Liat Melnick is the program administrator of the partnership.
We're looking for students who have the time. They're actually pretty busy in prison. They have full-time jobs, so people who have the time and the commitment to do this work.
There have been, throughout the 1970s, there were a number of guerrilla groups that were sort of operating on their own, so to speak.
Professor Jeannie Murphy teaches the course on Latin American history at the men's prison in Jessup. Her 10 students consult their textbooks, take notes, and enthusiastically engage in a conversation about politics and power. Their questions and observations are insightful. Their discussion is indistinguishable from the kind of dialogue that you'd expect to hear in any college classroom. Professor Murphy has taught at Goucher College for 7 years. Her first semester at Jessup was last spring.
I had my initial doubts and just thinking, why are they going to care about Latin America? And I was so pleasantly surprised right from day one. I feel almost like a sense of joy that the students have when we're having class. One day in particular that I can remember, that I came in through the library instead of there in the classroom where we usually meet up. There were some doors that were locked, and I came in a different way. And so I walked in, and some of them were already congregating in the library. And a few of them, when they saw me, turned and said, "Jeannie!" And I said, "You know what? I would love for my students at the main campus to react like that when I walk in the room. It just doesn't happen anymore."
Teachers in Goucher's program are paid as if they were teaching a course on the Towson campus. This fall, Professor Murphy volunteers as a tutor on Monday nights, and she hopes to be able to add a Spanish class to the curriculum soon. 96% of inmates in Maryland prisons are male. Most are black. The average age is about 37. Like Cedric Nettles, he's a big guy with a bald head and a huge smile. For Professor Murphy's Latin American history class, he wrote a report about the children of the men and women who were disappeared in Argentina in the 1970s and 80s.
How long was it before they started to look into what was going on in different countries, any other countries?
pretty much nothing is done until the people who are in power and allowing that to happen lose power.
Cedric was convicted of forgery and fraud. As of this spring, he'd been at Jessup for 3 years, and he says he likely has another 3.5 to go. He's been taking classes through Goucher since 2012.
I've taken pre-algebra, Chinese philosophy, understanding politics, English 103. I'm doing English 104 and Latin American history. The Chinese philosophy and the Latin American history, it's been a real good experience for me.
He showed his paper on the children of the disappeared in Argentina to producer Stephanie Hughes.
What made you choose this topic?
Because I have a fascination with things dealing with children. You know, I'm very sentimental when it comes to children because, you know, I've seen a lot. I've been through a lot as a child myself. So I get very emotional about things with children.
Cedric projects the quiet confidence of a man who knows he's moving forward.
I plan to start my own business once I go home. And if I can get involved with Goucher College or any other college and, you know, get a little bit of business background, you know, or a business major or whatever, then that would also help me to, you know, to run my business successfully.
None of the funding for the Goucher Prison Education Partnership comes from the state or from the tuition that the students on the Towson campus pay. The inmates' tuition and books are paid for with funding from foundations and individuals who donate specifically to the program. There is evidence to suggest that it's a good investment. Once again, Keramet Ryder, the criminology professor at UC Irvine.
The data is pretty uniform that people who get an education in prison tend to have both lower recidivism rates and higher incomes and employment rates.
Though she cautions that it can be hard to find rigorous studies looking at prison education. After just a couple of years, the Goucher program doesn't yet have data on the outcomes for their students once they get out of prison. But anecdotally, they do well. The students at Jessup cannot yet receive a degree from Goucher College, but they do receive credit for the courses they pass, which appear on a Goucher College transcript. When students are released from prison, they'll be able to transfer their credits to other institutions where they can earn a degree. But for Elizabeth Snarns, who's taking the political science class, it's not just about the degree. It's a matter of engaging in the culture of college and the possibilities an education creates. It's a culture she wishes she had embraced earlier.
I think it would have opened up a completely different social, not just a social aspect for me, but a completely different way of thinking. Knowledge is definitely power, as long as the knowledge is in the right aspect.
The students at Jessup understand what it means to have doors closed on them. And now, they're learning what might happen when some of those doors begin to open.
Tom Hall. He visited the prisons in Jessup with producers Matt Purdy and Stephanie Hughes in April 2014. The story first aired last October. We've got pictures from their visit on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, the movies you gotta catch. Stay with us on 88.1.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Hey, welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. On this frigid morning, I'm Sheila Cast. If you think it will be safe to venture out of your snowy nest for a movie this weekend, you're tuned to the right spot. Our movie mavens Jed Dietz, director of the Maryland Film Festival, and Anne Hornaday, film critic for the Washington Post, are with us to talk about some of their favorites. Hey, guys.
Hello. Good morning.
Now, Anne, before we get to specific cases, you're talking to us from the True False Film Festival in Columbia, Missouri. What's the action there?
This is a really terrific, I would call it little, but burgeoning and now big film festival that was started 12 years ago in the heart of the Midwest, in the heart of a Midwest winter, by some enterprising filmmakers. David Wilson is familiar to the people who come to the Maryland Film Festival. He's been a long-standing supporter of the Maryland Film Festival and started this little documentary festival out here. And it's really become a very highly regarded event. This is actually my first year being able to attend. I'm doing a panel tomorrow at the Based on a True Story conference that happens at the nearby University of Missouri campus. So today's the first day. I'm going to dive in and see what's happening, but I'm really thrilled to be here.
Great, great. Let's talk a little bit about how the Oscars played out. I mean, generally, you two made fabulous predictions, except Best Picture.
We both wanted Boyhood, yeah.
You wanted Boyhood. Yep. Now, Tom was quite frank. Tom Hall said he wanted Selma. That was the only reason he was voting for Selma. But I didn't hear you, Jadid, saying you wanted Boyhood. I heard you predicting that Boyhood would get Best Picture. And, of course, it went to Birdman.
You're right. That is, we both predicted it, but also because we wanted it. I mean, I think that Fused, I think it's the best movie in that group, and I think it's a very good group, but it was so bold in its making, as was Birdman, but I think in Boyhood's case, the execution was spot on. So that's why I thought
so
it would
win. So you're unrepentant.
I like Birdman too, though.
I think if I remember correctly, when I was making predictions, I did predict Birdman would win Best Picture, but I thought Linklater would at least get Best Director for what the reasons that Jed just said. I just thought no one could argue with what he did and his vision and his the execution of it. I mean, I was just really shocked that the Academy didn't recognize him personally for that. And also, I was disappointed that Sandra Adair, his editor, didn't win for editing, because again, I just don't see how you. I don't see how you argue with that accomplishment, but that's why it's a horse race.
What kind of effects are we seeing from Birdman having won?
Big jump in box office. I mean, I was looking at thinking about the show of what's happened through the years for Oscars, and the box office jump that happens with just nomination, beginning with nomination, has had a huge impact in the last 3 years. Half of the biggest jumps since 1982 happened in the last 3 years for films. American Sniper leading the pack, but Zero Dark Thirty to go back a couple of years. Selma got a big jump out of the nomination. So it's very interesting that the Oscars, and probably the whole award season, but the Oscars are the big kahuna and all that, are having a real impact on audience awareness and box office.
And nominations more than actually taking home the category?
Yeah, that varies. I mean, that can have a tremendous impact, but that varies tremendously over the years.
The movies that really benefited, if my memory serves, from actually winning were Slumdog Millionaire and King's Speech. I think King's Speech, my memory might be spotty, but I think it was just getting ready for its European push, and it just absolutely made a huge difference with that. And again, you know, this is why the awards season has become such an important alternative to the tentpole spectacle comic book business model. It's its own little business model where now people, and even studios, will make movies that are absolutely geared for these sorts of campaigns, these Oscar campaigns and marketing campaigns that pivot around nominations, which is why, for all of its ridiculousness and self-servingness, the awards season is really a very valuable way to guarantee a future for these movies.
It's interesting, and I was just looking at for winners, the biggest effect that I have found so far, I'm scanning this list, is My Left Foot actually had a 40% increase having won.
Wow.
Having won. So it's not just the chatter around the nomination, but winning counts for a lot at the box office.
It's both.
It's both. Yeah.
Right, and it depends on the release pattern. And you know, another movie that that nominations had a huge impact on this year was The Imitation Game, which just cleared $200 million, which is just, you know, I think American Sniper, it wasn't just the nominations, that
timing
had a lot of factors going into it. But Imitation Game, you can really say, you know, that being nominated, and it didn't really win that much except for adapted screenplay, and so you can really pinpoint that made a huge difference for that little movie.
That's true. I mean, and if you scan through the list, it's really interesting how many small movies have been impacted in box office by being nominated for Best Picture. So I think expanding the category is also very – what the Academy did just a couple of years ago has been important.
But it seems to me, and Anne, you said spotty memory. That's my middle name. But I seem to have heard some criticism of the nominations this year, among a lot of other criticisms that I'm quite sure I heard, but criticism that the movies that the Oscars that are nominated for Oscars and that all that discussion is about are not sort of the mainstream movies that most people go to, that they're art films and small films that,
sure.
that you know, that may do better than expected, but not much is expected in terms of how many people they're actually going to reach.
Sure, but I would say, so what? I mean, you know, we have rewards for hugely popular movies. They're called box office, for one thing, and they're called the People's Choice. And I think to a certain degree, the Golden Globes, you know, might, since they have so many more categories, that they have more room, perhaps, for those big popular hits. But frankly, I don't see a problem with that. I mean, the Academy is the Academy. It's a relatively small group of film professionals. It's no surprise to me, and it's not inappropriate to me, that they would want to make some, you know, choices that are quirky or idiosyncratic or maybe not terribly popular. I don't see any contradiction or problem with that whatsoever.
And I think it's actually sort of a perfect expression of this art form in America, because I think it does and always has combined art and commerce. And you talk to people in Hollywood who are totally involved in the business of it, the churn every day of the business. And they often have passion about a genre noir film or something that has no box office play at all. But that doesn't mean they don't care about it. And it doesn't mean that that doesn't somehow inform all the business churn that they go through. And that is part of movie making.
That's Jed Dietz here on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Sheila Kasten. With us by phone is Anne Hornaday, film critic of The Washington Post. Jed is the director of the Maryland Film Festival. Let's talk about some movies of this year. Leviathan, directed by Andre, I'm going to mispronounce this, Zyugintsev? Somebody who knows...
No, I don't know. It's
good. Well, I think. Zyugintsev.
At any rate, Leviathan, which is a Russian tragedy. What should we know about that?
Well, it was nominated for Best Foreign Film, and it's an extraordinary movie on many levels. It really shows a small town, very northern Russia up near Murmansk, the corruption in this town. And the corruption is petty but forceful. The film is beautifully shot in a sort of unbelievably bleak landscape, and the acting is extraordinary. And I hadn't heard, I mean, I couldn't pronounce the director's name because I'd never heard of him before. And that's true of most of the cast. It's been hugely controversial inside Russia, banned in many places because it's seen as an attack on Putin and et cetera, et cetera. And I think it is a deep cultural statement, also fascinating drama about what's going on in Russia post-Soviet Union.
And you said Leviathan is an indictment but also an elegy, a film set among the monumental ruins of a culture.
Oh, I said,
yes.
And I agree with me. It is. It's just a magnificent film. It's. I can't say enough about it. And as Jed said, it's just exquisitely, exquisitely shot. It's visually one of those movies that you really need to see on a big screen. Mm-hmm. I mean, you would be robbing yourself if you don't. And the way that Zyugintsev kind of threads this story out and unspools it, you're never sure where it's going to go. I don't want to give one little thing away about where it finally does go, because it becomes such an all-encompassing thing that it sort of takes your breath away. But it's all done within this very small, almost like Chekhov-like story of a man and his family and his home.
So tell us a little bit about where it starts. You don't have to tell us where it goes.
Right. But it has to do with a guy who lives in this tiny little town where the big industry is like a fish processing plant where his wife works, and he fixes cars, and he is involved in a land dispute with the powers that be in the town, the town bureaucracy involving the mayor and other administrators, and so it immediately plunges us into his court fights. And just the bureaucracy and the verbiage and the endless red tape and the lines and the waiting and you have to go here and there. I mean, you're immediately kind of intimately caught up with all of his, I said Chekhov, it's also Kafka-esque in terms of just how labyrinthine everything is. But then the story widens and more characters are introduced and more sort of extenuating factors are introduced. And there I shall leave you, because it's just mesmerizing. And like Jed said, the acting is impeccable. It just takes you right by the throat and just does not let you go. It's beautiful.
And I just want to reinforce seeing this on the big screen. I saw it on the big screen at the Charles, and it's so beautiful looking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we will leave it there and move on to Maps to the Stars. Why do we want to talk about that?
Well, Oscar winner Julianne Moore is the star. This is a film that Bruce Wagner wrote, David Cronenberg directed. It's been in the works in Hollywood for many years, 10, 12 years, with various directors. And it's another sort of attack on the culture of Hollywood business. But this one, I think, is so specifically formed around an actress at a certain time in her life who is struggling with all the issues that come with that. And Julianne Moore's performance, especially, I mean, I think she well-deserved Oscar for Still Alice. This is another one, a completely different character, and another place where she just threw herself completely into this role. And it's just awesome to see her do this.
And
I agree. I think she's the best thing in the movie. I'm not crazy about the movie. I think it's actually Wagner wrote it. I think it was actually as many as 20 years ago. Oh. And it feels sort of dated to me, and it also feels pretty facile in terms of just pot shots at Hollywood excesses and superficiality and cynicism. And I feel like we've seen that before, and we've probably seen it done better. But I agree with Jed about Moore's performance. She plays this an actress, you know, facing obsolescence, trying to stay relevant and dealing with some psychological issues having to do with her mother, who was also an actress. And it is an absolutely bravura performance. I mean, it's just stunning. So for that alone, I think it's probably worth seeing.
And you wrote a column just before the Oscar presentations headlined, "After 100 Years, We Still Don't Know How to Actually Watch a Movie." What is it we don't know?
Yeah. Well, you know, it wasn't so much the general audience that I was talking about. It was written at the end of that Oscar campaign season, which seems like every year we get more caught up with fact-checking movies, especially reality-based and history-based movies. Which often do end up being nominated for Oscars, so it's kind of it's kind of a convergence of those two things. But I do think, you know, I think that's an interesting conversation to have. I'm not saying we shouldn't, and I think this year, especially Selma was put under the microscope for the deviations that it made from historical record. And again, I thought those were really interesting conversations, but I do think that at some point they do tend to obscure the fact that we are talking about an art form that has, that has certain formal conventions that either work or don't, but I think films deserve to be judged on those merits, and that historical fiction is fiction, and it's dramatized history, and we focus on the history without really taking into account the virtuosity of the drama. So I felt like, you know, even though those were interesting conversations to have, I wanted to kind of remind readers of the fact that let's bring it back to the art form, which, with luck, the Oscars will do, and that's what which we were talking about earlier. You know, that's what the Academy is trying to reward. And I was linking it, the 100 years piece was linking it to The Birth of a Nation, which came out 100 years ago, almost to the day in February. Which itself, you know, contributed so much to the art form of filmmaking, while of course being very rightfully criticized for the rank distortions of history that it perpetuated.
Jed, last word.
I agree with all that, and I think just specifically about Selma, I think you can say how you feel about the portrayal of Lyndon Johnson, which was sort of the center of the controversy. And I would argue that there could have been heightened drama if they had portrayed him more accurately, actually, with the relationship with King. The two of them could have been even more fascinating than it was in the movie. But I think what Anne's point is, and I agree with this very strongly, that we have to remember it took 50 years to get that film made from the historic event. And the dramatic power of the film, whatever you want to say about it and how you would make it better or suggest and stuff, I think that is a huge addition to our culture to see that event, that those series of events recreated in movie. And why it's so powerful just being done as a movie, I don't know. But it is.
Got to leave it there. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anne.
Anne Hornaday, film critic for The Washington Post. Jed Dietz, director of the Maryland Film Festival. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. There's more ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay with us on 88.1.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. The watermen of Tillman Island, population 854, had been harvesting perch, shad, oysters, herring, and rockfish for centuries when scientific fisheries management became a widely used tool for regulating the fish harvest in the United States. The idea is to manage annual harvests so aquatic species can be harvested in perpetuity. In the late 1970s, the rockfish population was in crisis, and Congress passed a law that imposed a moratorium on striped bass or rockfish. These days, the fish are at a more sustainable level, and rockfish are again being fished under rules about the kinds of nets that can be used, the size of the fish, total weight of each haul, and the times of year they can be fished. Journalist and documentary filmmaker Catherine Rents has been reporting for the Baltimore Sun about a multi-year, $500,000 rockfish poaching operation on the Eastern Shore. And she's with me here in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Sheila.
Start by telling us what the watermen on Tillman Island were doing that was illegal.
Several things. They were setting nets before the season opened. Secondly, they anchored their nets. So you're supposed to drift net, meaning watermen are supposed to stay with the nets. They were actually anchoring them and leaving them to be in the water for several days. Apart from that, they were falsifying documents to the state, to the check-in centers where they report the fish. So they were essentially underreporting what they were actually selling to fish markets in several different states. And lastly, what they were doing is selling it across state lines. The folks who were selling it, Michael Hayden, it was the one who was in charge of this, did not have a license to do so. So they were selling this fraudulently caught fish across state lines. And that is really what got them into big trouble, because that got the feds involved. That got the Fish and Wildlife Service involved. And
because
that,
it was an interstate.
It was interstate. And that meant instead of just getting a citation that would maybe be $100 or $200, that meant that they would get several thousands of dollars worth of fines, restitution, as well as prison time.
How did regulators discover this operation?
Well, it actually came from an anonymous text to a police officer. And this I just learned in the recent sentencing. The Natural Resources Police was out there in the bay, on the eastern part of the bay. They knew the rockfish season was about to start, and somebody gave them an anonymous text. Hey, I think there is some illegal nets out there. Been out there for several days. So the officers go out to the Bloody Point Lighthouse, near the Bloody Point Lighthouse. They stick a stick down essentially into the water, and they start feeling for nets. And sure enough, they came upon a net. Now, this is not unusual. The officers have been finding nets for years up and down the bay. So what this officer did was just, he saw where it was. He said, I'm going to do a stakeout. I want to catch whoever's doing this. I'm sick of finding all of these nets underwater.
So this was in February of 2011.
This was in February of 2011. And, well, he actually found it at the end of January 31st. So February 1st, 2011, the season opens. Roy Rafter, Officer Roy Rafter with Maryland Department of Natural Resources, hides behind Bloody Point Lighthouse along with another officer, waiting to see who pulls up the nets. Before sunrise, there were a few boats that came out. One headed straight for them. the watermen actually shone a flashlight, shone a spotlight on the officers. And the officers were trying to do this without being seen so they could catch somebody actually physically pulling up the net. Well, they were found out. So what happens is that the watermen leave, the officers leave, sunrise comes, they go back to the nets. Both go back to the nets. So the police go back to the nets to confiscate the fish and see what they can do with it, because at this point they realize they're found out. The problem for them, though, is that Michael Hayden and Billy Ludnam, the two captains operating that rockfish boat that morning, came back and confronted DNR. And according to the investigation, according to court documents, Michael Hayden really had it out with Roy Rafter and the others. He actually tried to lay another net on top of the nets that were already, you know, his illegal nets, so that the police couldn't pull them up. So he tried to impede their taking of the illegal nets.
On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with journalist and documentary filmmaker Catherine Rentz about her recent reporting in the Baltimore Sun about rockfish over-harvesting by several watermen based on Tillman Island. When the Department of Natural Resources police actually pulled up the nets and counted, there were like 10 tons of rockfish in those nets, which right. was an incredibly huge haul. Correct?
It was an enormous amount of fish. It was more than Roy Rafter, the officer who's been a police for Natural Resources for the past 10 years. He's never seen anything like it. It was so heavy that when Officer Rafter tried to pull it up with his boat, he couldn't. His boat literally started sinking, and so he called for help. Another patrol boat came by, and then they finally had to get, you know, that still wasn't enough, so they had to get the icebreaker, a Maryland Department of Natural Resources icebreaker called the Widener. And so that came, and that's how they hauled up all of the fish.
Fast forward through some of your reporting. William Billy Ludlam and Michael Hayden have both pled guilty. They've both been sentenced to jail time, prison time. Mm-hmm. Ludnam to a year in prison, Hayden to 18 months. What's been the reaction in the Tillman fishing community to this case and to these sentences?
Well, it's interesting. When I went down there, I thought that locals would be upset, especially other watermen, because as a result of this case, local watermen had their quotas reduced significantly that season. So they lost money. But in fact, when I talked to a bunch of other watermen, they thought that really DNR and federal officials used too heavy of a hand on these guys. They thought it was an overreach of enforcement. And they were defensive of these guys. And one of the things that you realize whenever you go to Tillman Island is that they love so interdependently, way more so than the rest of us. I mean, just this past week with the ice, there were a couple of boats that were sinking because of ice, and they called out to other watermen to help them. I mean, they really depend upon each other for many things. And so they don't like to rat each other out. The other thing I learned is that one of the reasons why they were defensive of these guys is that many other people were allegedly doing the same thing. I had one waterman tell me he was setting nets the same time before season, the same way as Ludnam and Hayden. Several other watermen confirmed there were several other people, several other watermen doing the same thing that morning. And so they felt like these guys were taking a fall for a lot of other people.
I really appreciate your talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila.
Journalist and documentary filmmaker Catherine Rentz reports for the Baltimore Sun. We have links to her articles about rockfish poaching on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too. Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio.
WYPR
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Estelle Klein
and Catherine Sway.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. On the web at ZEKESCoffee.com.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1856, the Maryland Agricultural College was chartered. It would go bankrupt within a decade, be revived by the state legislature, and develop into the University of Maryland College Park. Have a great weekend. Join us again on Monday.